We are closing in on 2 weeks before the start of the Winter Olympics in South Korea. The Russian Olympic team has been barred from competing in the games because of a doping scheme that corrupted several Olympics. When they barred Russia last month, Olympic officials left a side door open for athletes who could prove they were clean. And our conversation on this hour of the morning show is, what does clean really mean and why does it matter? Is a level playing field in sport even achievable? Tom Murray thinks about this a lot as chair of the Ethical Issues Review Panel for the World Anti-Doping Agency. He's a former director of the Hastings Center and for the Center for Biomedical Ethics in the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. His new book is Good Sport, Why Our Games Matter and How Doping Undermines Them. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much and good morning.
Good morning. So what is the point of having anti-doping initiatives? Why do they matter?
Because many, many athletes would like to be able to compete and have whatever success they can achieve based on their natural talents and how hard and skillfully they work to perfect them. And doping undermines the connection between talent, dedication, and athletic performance.
Do the world powers agree on a definition of doping, or is there still gray area?
Well, there's really two questions hidden there, Kate, if I may. The first is there a general agreement on what doping in concept is? Yes, I think there is now general agreement. There wasn't always. A former head of the International Olympic Committee once said, well, for me, doping is only if it affects health. If it improves performance, that doesn't make a difference. That's just wrong. So they agree in concept. Now, whether any particular technology, if it's a pill or an injection or a machine even, whether it should count as doping, that's a question that has to be worked out for each individual candidate. So, for example, all of the anabolic steroids now are regarded as doping.
Well, where does, for instance, technology come in terms of a faster swimsuit for swimmers or a particular type of skate or a particular type of pole vault?
I love it that you're using examples from the book. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Took a long time to actually figure out which examples to use. So let's look at the swimsuits. None of those are doping. Those are all cases where there are technologies that appeared that allowed increased performances by athletes. The swimsuits, our listeners may remember, were these amazing suits. They covered the full body. Mm-hmm. Arms and legs included. They had a super slippery surface, so they would more slide through the water than grab it. And they were impermeable. That is, they kept all the water out and all the air in. And records were being just broken, meat after meat, with these new swimsuits. One of the qualities the swimsuits had was they trapped air beneath the suit and the body. Which meant that actually boosted swimmers a little bit out of the water. I did read one account of an American swimmer who won a race by wearing three suits, one on top of another. Each one trapped a little bit more air, and so she became, with each suit, she became more buoyant. And when you realize that the resistance offered by water is about 700 times the resistance offered by air, you can see the advantage of being sort of lifted above the water, even a little bit. Eventually, the sport of swimming decided, look, this was just really, these suits were undermining what we think swimming ought to be about, which was some combination of the athletic gifts, the techniques that, skilled swimmers learn and such. And it was more rewarding sort of largely muscled persons who could sort of be buoyant on top of the water and plow their way through. And so swimming said, okay, these suits are now banned. Now that you can't have a whole body suit, it's got to be, it can't be impermeable, it's got to be let water through. and swimming has returned more to its roots.
So where does that leave us then with the complement of this, which is performance-enhancing drugs, which is perhaps nutritional supplements, and all of this whole side gig that athletes are doing to make themselves more able to win on the field or whatever sport they're in?
Clearly, lines have to be drawn, and drawing lines can be difficult at times. But just remember how sport works. I mean, Kate, may I ask if there are any sports that you play or really like watching?
Figure skating. Yes.
Okay. My two of my granddaughters do that, but I really don't know that much about the details of the sport, except that the judging is damnably difficult and susceptible to corruption. We've seen that happen in the past Olympics.
Tom Murray is with us. He is an international bioethics expert. His new book is Good Sport, Why Our Games Matter and How Doping Undermines Them. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think countries can fight doping? Do advocates of clean competition stand a chance when incentives exist to give athletes drugs so they perform better? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tom Murray, how do we draw the line at disavowing certain drugs but letting athletes take other substances? Delve into this area a little bit more.
Sure. Let's go back to the issue, though, of drawing lines in sport in the first place. It's in the very nature of sport that the rules define the conditions of play. You didn't mention baseball, and it's the Hall of Fame has just voted in some, six candidates, which is one of the biggest classes ever. But baseball is a very curious sport. The dimensions of the field have been consistent for a very long time, well over a century. And one of the most peculiar distances in the sport is that between the pitcher's rubber, the pitcher has to have his foot, one foot in contact with the rubber as the ball is released, and home plate. And I ask in a talk, I would ask people to tell me what the distance is. Somebody will know. It's 60 feet, 6 inches. It's not 60 feet. It's not 61 feet. It's 60 feet, 6 inches. Why? Is that arbitrary? Well, in a sense, of course it is. It could have been 60 or 61 feet. It could have been 50 feet or 80 feet. The fact is that particular distance works. It allows for a meaningful competition between the pitcher and the batter. Move the pitcher in 20 feet, the batter would be helpless. It would be a game of bunting. Move the pitcher out another 20 feet, and it would be like pitching batting practice. So the rules are meant to allow for a contontest of skill and savvy of one athlete against another.
So, and there is such subtlety there that you're getting at.
Yes, I hope so. I was in Europe once talking to a group of European philosophers, very skeptical about anti-doping. They just didn't understand how you could draw any of the lines that you alluded to just a moment ago. What's the difference between anabolic steroids and a special diet? They just thought we should do away with any effort to control drugs in sports. And I suggested to them that soccer, we call it soccer, the rest of the world calls it football. The sport of soccer, the goal in soccer is 12 feet wide for adult soccer. I said, Americans like scoring. Why don't we double the width of the goal to 24 feet? Be a much more interesting game for Americans. They were horrified.
Hmm.
And I had committed heresy with that tongue-in-cheek suggestion. And the answer is really similar to the answer in baseball. 12 feet wide allows for a meaningful contest between this deception and skill of the striker, person kicking the ball, and the skill and savvy of the goalkeeper. So the rules of sport the limits we set in sport, the lines we draw, are meant to make for meaningful and interesting contests. And the question is, where does doping fall in that in the continuum of things we can do, things we can do to ourselves that would affect our performance in sport?
Let's bring in Matt, who joins us from Fitchburg, who wants to talk about baseball. Matt, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was glad that your guest mentioned baseball, because here in Wisconsin, we've, of course, dealt with the Ryan Braun issue. And to me, the things that both the Olympics and the major league sports need to do is they need to do two things. One, they need to increase the amount of investment they put into their testing programs, including using the best testing available, which they do not do. And two, the penalties need to be much more severe. The incentives to cheat are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and there just is not any penalties that account for that.
Tom Murray, your reaction to what Matt's saying here?
Well, thanks, Matt. So I think Matt and I are in agreement that doping should be kept out of sport as far as we can. I don't know the details of the Major League Baseball testing program. I know that initially it was more of an IQ test. That is, any athlete who was caught had to be really stupid, because they gave, they gave advance warning. They didn't do out of competition testing. I think they've gotten more serious, but I don't know the details. In terms of sanctions, I agree. I think it's interesting. I've been in many groups that have talked about doping in sport. If I can make one generalization, is those people who are the most adamant about severe sanctions are athletes. They want the dopers punished severely. The rest of us might be, more willing to forgive or at least modify a punishment. But those athletes, frankly, are getting screwed by the ones who dope. The clean athletes are.
Matt, thanks for joining us. Some questions we're exploring this hour on elite athletes. Why do we ban steroids and other drugs, but not nutritional supplements? Why are super slippery swimsuits banned, but not fiberglass vaulting poles? Tom Murray stays with us. He's an international bioethics expert. His new book is Good Sport: Why Our Games Matter and How Doping Undermines Them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think countries can fight doping? Do advocates of clean competition stand a chance when incentives exist to give athletes drugs so they perform better? And athletes, have you been tempted to use performance-enhancing drugs? Join in with your story or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll return in just a moment on the Ideas Network. The book is Good Sport. Author and longtime sports ethicist Tom Murray stays with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He writes, of the 30 Tour de France riders who stood on the podium, these were top finishers from 1998 through 2007. At least 22 of them have either confessed or been officially linked to using performance-enhancing drugs. We're learning that the usual reason athletes decide to dope is their inherent belief that their competition is already doing so. What do you think about this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Is a shadow hanging over the games in South Korea? What do you think Olympic leaders need to do to rebuild the integrity of international sports? Join in or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Brady now in Madison. Hi, Brady.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
So as somebody who uses true anabolic steroids, I've always been of the opinion that it has an absolute place in sport. And I can understand, especially like in an international competition, you don't want some athletes who have access to things like trenbolone or oxandrolone to have an unfair advantage. But something like sinotropin or like growth hormone, right? something that can make everyone recover, everyone have their best shot to perform at every single race. And if they all had equal access, how is that wrong? Especially when it's a hormone in the body. It's not even a precursor. It's not a stimulant. It's not an amphetamine. It's not a suit that one has that one doesn't. But it's actually a hormone from the body. I mean, that just mystifies me. By the way, I loved your book. I'm going to take this off the air. Thank you for finally covering something that matters, like, to me. Yeah, you guys are great. I love you guys.
Brady, some compelling words there. Tom Murray, how about that? That should be on the back of your book.
Well, I love the review in the end. I think I'm very grateful to Brady for calling and speaking so candidly and for raising at least two different questions. But the question is, should we allow athletes to use something like anabolic steroids? Now, you may know, if you know the history of this, great. Anabolic steroids were administered probably involuntarily to girls and boys in East Germany in the 1970s, because East Germany was determined to show the superiority of its political system. And in fact, they dominated the women's Olympic swimming for a long time. One American swimmer mentioned the deep voices of her East German competitors, and their coach said, "They came here to swim, not sing." So, I mean, that shows the depths of cynicism into which people can sink. There are sports like weightlifting, where there have been eras in weightlifting, Olympic weightlifting, where there was no way you could be competitive if you didn't use anabolic steroids, because all of your competitors were. And the athletes knew that. So one of the answers to Brady is, whatever you permit, it will immediately become the absolute minimum that every athlete will have to do just in order to remain competitive when there's a drug that makes a difference, like steroids and weightlifting. So that's an important observation.
Hundreds of Russian athletes are not allowed to compete in South Korea in a couple of weeks. The International Olympics Committee is considering appeals from a few dozen athletes who may be allowed to compete, not for Russia, but as from Russia. The IOC president says only clean athletes with not the slightest doubt or suspicion may compete. How do we eliminate doubt and suspicion under these circumstances?
Well, we certainly don't do it successfully by the approach the International Olympic Committee has taken so far. So what's happened is, you're right, there are some 40-some cases that are being heard on appeal right now. To my knowledge, none of those individuals are actually candidates to compete in Pyongyang. But Russia submitted 500 names of athletes that they wanted preclearance on, so that they could put together a representation of athletes from Russia. Most observers think it's unlikely that perhaps 200 Olympic athletes from Russia will be allowed to compete. Not that many fewer than they had in Sochi. And so there's a great deal of discomfort among other athletes, and also in the anti-doping world. The problem is, the IOC has a process and criteria. We know a little bit about the process. We know virtually nothing about the criteria they're using to certify athletes as clean. And they've certified 389 provisionally as clean.
Why isn't there more transparency?
Because the IOC hasn't provided it. It is a mystery to many of us, including the International Organization of National Anti-Doping Groups, why they won't do that. I can't see how it helps the IOC. I can't see how it helps sport or even the Russian athletes to have this sort of veil of this cloud of secrecy over the criteria and the process.
Let's go to Joy now, who joins us from New London. Hi, Joy.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Kate. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is two quick things, and I guess I'm looking at it more from a moral standpoint. I'm 55. I just turned a senior, and I've been watching the Olympics and a variety of sports. We used to gather around the TV when I was about 5 years old. We all watched the Olympics, and I just wonder, where is the original passion and desire just to draw from what you can do on your own in your own body's strength without having to rely on all these, the tools and, like you said, Tom, the money. And where's the true passion behind that, and where has their moral compasses gone? There's just such a difference between now and years ago, rather than big money dollars or who. And then the second part of that real quick is, and then I'll take my comments off the air. What about the records that have been set by some of these people? I mean, I look at Lance Armstrong, things like that, where they would have been doping. How are they going to justify that? And how, I mean, I know that's not necessarily your area to answer that, but I would just like your opinion on that, of how you think that might factor in. And thank you so much.
Joy, thanks for the call. Tom, two-part question. Go ahead.
Well, another terrific. You've got great callers.
We
this
do.
Is my first experience.
Great listener.
With you, so. It's terrific. I know many athletes. I mean, that one of the benefits of being in this world of sport and anti-doping for so long is I've met some wonderful people, including mostly former athletes rather than current ones, but some current ones. I think, Joy, the passion is there. I mean, you don't go through what these people have to go through, the years of sacrifice, hard work, giving up so, you know, or at least minimizing other interests in your life just in order to reach that peak of excellence that would allow you to qualify for an Olympic game. It takes real passion. Now, the reality is you also need support. You need good coaches. You need someone to help, you know, pay your bills, find have a place to live and something to eat. And look, there are American athletes as recently as, I think, the Sochi Games, who some of them were on food stamps. I mean, you know, not every sport pays well. Some do. Some are incredibly lucrative. But in many of the people we'll see in Pyongyang in a couple of weeks are there just because of their talent, their dedication, and their love for the game.
What about world records, the second part of her question?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, right? So when doping was very prominent in racing, in athletics and running, and also in swimming. And what you saw was this establishment of world records, some of which have yet, years and years later, decades later, have yet to be exceeded. So there's talk about, should we create a special category for that era, the record set in the era that we know doping was prevalent in a particular sport. That's an active conversation. Look, there are people who want to put an asterisk around Bobby Bonds' home run record, right?
Mm.
Because it was, you know, you'd have to be a fool not to know that he was using anabolic steroids, and I don't know what else he was using. So that will be, as long as records exist in sport, that will be an active debate. And that's healthy, I think.
Tom Murray, what is the cost of running these anti-doping worldwide programs, having people, officials, to show up on an athlete's doorstep in any place, any part of the world, at any given time, to carry out these anti-doping initiatives? That must be very costly.
Last figures I saw, it runs into the tens of millions, but it also is something like 0.3% of the income generated by sport.
Mm.
So it's a third of a percent. I mean, if you're serious about trying to create a clean sport, sport that is clean, sport can afford to do it.
So we know doping is bad, we think. Doping is banned, and yet Russia and other countries or individual athletes, why do organizations turn to performance-enhancing drugs, despite warnings, despite they know that they are breaking rules?
Well, because they're human beings, morally imperfect creatures, because they know it works. So the single most important insight I got into this whole world of doping was when I began my work almost 40 years ago, and I began by talking, more listening to some elite athletes, Olympians and professionals, and their coaches and others involved in that world. And, you know, the answer was, why, I asked, why does anybody dope? And the answer is, well, if I'm doping, it's because I don't want to lose to that other guy or girl who I know isn't as talented or hardworking as I am, but is getting a significant enough boost from the drugs they're taking that they could still beat me. And it was that ultimate frustration that no matter how hard I work, no matter how talented I am, if doping works and somebody else is doing it, I'm going to lose.
Tom Murray is with us. He is spent time as the leading ethical issues review panel for the World Anti-Doping Agency. His new book is Good Sport, Why Our Games Matter and How Doping Undermines Them. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What matters most in international sports? Is it ethical competition? Is it entertainment value? How does knowing some athletes get away with doping affect your view as a spectator, affect your view of the Winter Olympics just ahead in a couple weeks? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tom Murray, what takeaways, what insights can we gain from how the Paralympics is dealing with Russian doping?
Well, you may know that for the Rio Games, when the doping in Sochi was, by that point, the doping in Sochi had been pretty well exposed, that the International Paralympic Committee, which stages its games right after the International Olympic Committee's games in the same venue, so later in that summer in Rio, the IPC banned all Russian representation because of the doping. The IOC wasn't as courageous, and they left it to each of the federations that govern their particular sports to decide what to do. So International Athletics banned the Russians, but other sports were quite lenient and let many Russian athletes compete.
Is there a different sense you get what is happening in the Winter Olympics as to their approach with how to deal with countries like Russia and athletes who dope?
I'm not sure I know what the International Paralympic Committee is, shorthand as IPC acronym. I don't know what their attitude in the end will be. It wouldn't surprise me to have them be rigorous once again, as they were in Rio. But until, if they have announced their position, I'm afraid I don't know what it is yet. The IOC, as we know, has made, they claim to have some sanctions against the Russian Olympic organization. And so their athletes are not going to be allowed to wear uniforms that display the Russian flag. And if they win a medal, they're not going to have the Russian anthem played when they stand on the podium. But they've left the back door open even for that to change in the final, in the closing ceremonies.
Let's explore other areas beyond drugs, things like blood doping or hypoxic chambers. What about enhancing the body's performance without using pharmaceuticals? Where are we with that?
Well, it's interesting. Blood doping. One of the first friends I made, a former athlete, was Connie Carpenter Finney. Connie won a gold for the U.S. in the very first time that they staged a bicycle road race in the Olympic Games. Connie beat her teammate by, you know, the width of a rim, who was blood doping. Now, blood doping is you take blood, you take it, if you do it smart, and I don't advise blood doping at all, but people who are doing it in a safer form will give their own blood. They will freeze that. They will give their body enough time to regenerate the blood. They may do it. They may do that a number of times, a number of cycles. So that blood is now frozen and stored, and it's their own blood. When it comes time for an event, they have a unit of blood reinfused into their body. You pretty quickly use your body pretty quickly excretes the excess fluid in that, but it retains the red blood cells. And the red blood cells are the fuel for the body. They're carrying oxygen to your tissues. And in any endurance sport, be it bicycling, cross-country skiing, or the road race, endurance is the limiting factor. So if I can increase my endurance by blood doping, by upping my hematocrit, I'll have an advantage.
How widespread is blood doping? Do we know?
Well, it was quite prevalent in the American cycling team in that Olympic Games. Lance Armstrong used it, again, using his own blood, just exactly the way I described. He and other cyclists have done that. It's banned, the cycling keeps, these days, is trying to keep a close watch on things like needles and blood bags, so that if they find any evidence of those, then the athletes are suspect.
Let's address the Tour de France and the mindset of cyclers as they approach doping and whether to do it or not to do it. Compelling opening to your book about just the ethical tug of war going on as cyclists approach a neatly folded brown paper bag and knowing what's in it and how it could impact their performance. How have these cyclists approached doping?
At the peak of doping in the Tour de France, basically the peak Lance Armstrong years and some following them, if you were a rational cyclist, you would probably calculate that it's impossible to succeed in this event without doping, without the use of the blood doping that we just described, without the use of the synthetic hormone EPO, erythropoietin, which tells the stem cells in your bone marrow to make red blood cells, which has this similar effect of increasing your stamina. And you would make that calculation. And in fact, if you were a teammate of Lance Armstrong's, you had to follow whatever doping regimen was prescribed for you, or you'd be off the team. Some cyclists did it. It's easy, at least I feel like I can understand how they get to that place. I mean, you're very talented. You've won races as a young rider. You begin winning regional championships, you become a nationally prominent rider, you go to Europe to be part of the elite peloton in cycling, and you discover there's no way I'm going to survive here if I don't dope like everybody else. Some athletes go along with it, like Tyler Hamilton, who has since claims he regrets it deeply. Some athletes continue to race, like Bradley McGee, don't have the success that their talents probably warranted. And some, like Scott Mercier, an American cyclist, say, I can't do this. I love the sport, but it's just, I can't succeed if I don't dope, so I'm leaving. But that's a terrible choice. We shouldn't have any athlete who loves their sport feel like they have to dope or quit.
Let's bring in Jeff now, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
They're a huge topic. I was both an Olympic speed skater and Olympic coach for speed skating long track, and I was in Sochi, and I've had a long career looking at this stuff, and it's, basically I think the IOC has been looking the other way for most dirty samples for a long, long time, all the way back to Flojo. She was totally dirty. And recently, you can look at athletes, and the one thing I just want to comment on, Tom, on your work is if it doesn't look normal, it isn't. And I can cite, in 1994, there was a Norwegian speed skater. I won't name him, but he gets done with a 5 and 10,000 and is jumping up and down, picking up flowers off the ice. That's not natural after a max effort, and that's either doping or erythropoietin or some type of steroid enhancement, because it's not normal. If it doesn't look normal, there are no gods in humans. Humans are human, and I wanted to see what you had to say about that.
Kate, is it possible to ask Jeff a question?
It is. Certainly. Go ahead, Tom.
Jeff, are you still on?
Yeah.
He is.
Hi. So did you have any, when you were in Sochi, were there any inklings about the performances of the Russian athletes at that time?
Well, I mean, there's a woman named Olga Fatkalina who looked dirty. I mean, she had all the markings of steroid use from her body type. Her face changed. She's being banned from the Olympics this time. But we've suspected a lot of the Russians, and not just Russians, Italians. There's a lot, and Northern Europeans, you know, the cyclists you were mentioning, that bleeds over into speed skating in Italy and Austria. And, you know, I don't have proof of individuals. I'm just saying that the cult is there. And we did not know specifically about the scandal that was going on right under our noses at Sochi. We did not know about that.
Yeah, who could have, right? They were very skilled. The Russians had, in the doping lab, they had a hole in the wall, and in a nearby building, they had clean urine samples from athletes. And when an athlete was tested, they would switch the urine sample. So they would pass it out through this hole in the wall to the Russian Secret Service, the FSB, who would then go and retrieve it, open the supposedly unopenable sample bottles, untamperable ones, and they could put the clean urine back in. So it was an amazingly skillful and cynical system.
Russian athletes at the Winter Olympics will technically compete under the Olympic flag with no Russian emblems identifying them or appearing at the opening ceremony. Nonetheless, Russian athletes and officials have expressed pride that their athletes will be referred to by the acronym OAR, Olympic Athlete from Russia. Meanwhile, the president of the International Olympic Committee has called Russia's cheating reflective of an unprecedented level of criminality. We're exploring how to think about sports and artificial enhancements with Tom Murray. His new book is Good Sport, and he's chair of the Ethical Issues Review Panel for the World Anti-Doping Agency. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do performance-enhancing drugs threaten the purity of Olympic rivalry? Or is it fair to use biotechnology to propel athletes to success? Join in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in a moment. Critics of anti-doping work say that the way to eliminate unfairness is to give everyone access to performance-enhancing drugs and other technologies. Is this a flawed argument? We're exploring where performance-enhancing drugs fit in at the intersection of natural talents, at the intersection of dedication and discipline to perfect those talents, and the courage to test yourself and risk failure. Tom Murray stays with us. His new book is called Good Sport, Why Our Games Matter and How Doping Undermines Them. You can join in the conversation about doping at 800-642-1234. Is it ethical competition? Is it entertainment value? How does knowing that some athletes get away with doping affect your view of the Winter Olympics? Does it change the way you watch the Olympics? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rich in Rhinelander emailed and said, when doping comes into the picture, competitive sports show that we've lost the old idea that winning isn't everything and it matters how you play the game. We're living now through an era where when we are told there are winners, there are losers, nothing else matters. The value of winning cannot overshadow the value of true competition. Tom, what do you make of that?
Well, I love what Rich had to say. I mean, when I really began my work on the book, I was dealing with the argument that you offered, which is you could level the playing field by just letting everybody use drugs. Right? That's a pretty common response. There are several problems with that, and the book deals at length with the many problems with that argument. It falls apart for a number of reasons. I don't want to bore your listeners by going through all of them. But what the point Rich made was that, look, sport is deeply embedded in a world of important values and meanings. If you play any sport, as you say, you love figure skating, you know what it is that good figure skating, what it takes to skate well, how to tell whether someone is a great skater or not. You understand that. And if there were a way of sort of shortcutting the quest for excellence in any sport, including figure skating, most people would, you know, raise their eyebrows at that. It just, again, it undermines that connection between whatever talents we may have how willing we are to work to perfect those talents and our actual performance.
Drugs
are a shortcut, and they sap meaning from that connection.
Tom, how much does politics and world order and the politics of the world play into whether countries create ways that athletes can use these drugs and get away with it?
Well, sadly, it can be very powerful. I mean, the speculation is that Vladimir Putin, whose popularity had been waning somewhat in Russia, ordered the operation in Sochi in order to put Russia atop the medals table, and he succeeded, at least until the world figured out that doping had been going on, and many of those medals have now been taken back from the Russians. So the initial purpose was, I think, entirely political. That was true in the East German story I told. That was in the 70s and 80s. And it's been true in other times and places. Look, the United States has not been all clean in this matter itself in the past. The world did change. A couple of things changed the environment, though. One was the creation of the World Anti-Doping Agency. It's a human institution. It's not perfect. It's susceptible to, I'm sure, all kinds of entities try to influence it. But my sense is they have integrity, and they've tried to do the right thing. And there are plenty of people, the professionals who work there, try to do the right thing. I should add, I'm no longer the chair of that panel. That ended about a year ago. I'm now the ex-chair. But I'm working with International Athletics on their ethics board and disciplinary tribunal. One thing was the creation of the person, WADA, and now the national entities, including the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, which has been very successful and very skillful. They're the ones who basically blew the whistle on Lance Armstrong. They made the case against him. And there are other nations' anti-doping entities that are also have tremendous integrity and professionalism. The second thing that changed is that we learned a new way of looking at athletes who are doping, what's called the biological passport. So these days, if you are, say, a significant Olympic candidate, you'll have a blood sample taken, very small amount taken, several times over the course of each year. And we'll be able to see a steady state for your physiology. If you take any kind of powerful performance-enhancing drugs, you'll see, that steady state will be disturbed. And we can now look for evidence of doping from those kinds of perturbations in athletes' physiology.
Let's go to Martin now, who joins us from Duluth. Hi, Martin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm tuning in late, but I do not think sports is healthy. There's something dysfunctional about sports in general, where you have to, in order to win, you have to beat somebody. And I just want to know if you have any comments about that.
Is there something fundamentally dysfunctional about sporting?
Well, it can. I take Martin's point. I try to be active athletically. I'm a cyclist, but I don't race. I don't try to beat anybody. I test myself against myself. I don't think that's fundamentally unhealthy that athletes compete to win. It's unhealthy when it becomes the only reason, or the prime, becomes that anything will be done in the quest to win. That's when it gets unhealthy. In fact, I'm very interested also in youth sport. And if you look at the numbers, there are tens of millions of young Americans who are playing organized sport of one kind or another, everything from soccer to baseball to track and field, and other sports, lesser known sports. And I think it can be an extraordinarily healthy experience. I was part of the panel that oversaw a survey that the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency did some years ago. And we asked young people, their parents and coaches, and some of the general public a series of questions. And for my mind, the most important, the most interesting answer we asked, why does a young person play sport? Can you guess what the first answer was?
Why was that?
Fun.
But when does the fun go away?
Well, when adults try to, you know, make it too serious, because in fact the main reason young people quit playing sport is when it ceases to be fun.
You've spent decades in anti-doping work. Why do you think it's worth the effort?
Because athletes shouldn't be forced to have to use powerful drugs just in order to have a chance to be successful in their sport. Clean athletes ought to have a darn good chance of success, again, based on how talented they are and how hard and skillfully they work to bring those talents to their highest perfection. That's to me, that's not a complicated thing. Sport can be beautiful. It's a way that we connect with our bodies. The disconnect between our bodies and the rest and our lives, it becomes particularly acute. And I'm sitting here in front of a computer terminal, right? Computer screen. So it's easy to kind of forget our bodies. And sport is a wonderful way of making the connection, reigniting the connection between our wills and minds and our bodies. And so I hope we will continue to play.
Performance-enhancing drugs, though, is a moving target, continually evolving. How do you wrap your arms around it? Do anti-doping programs even have a chance?
It's always going to be a battle. What happens, though, is sometimes you can change a culture. I think the culture of bicycle racing, for example, has had a massive reform since the Armstrong era. Many teams now are deeply committed to fielding teams that are clean. Weightlifting had been horribly infected with doping, and I wouldn't say that they're 100% clean, but they really have made a turnaround. And it is possible in a sport to have things change for the better. So you got to work on the culture. You have to help young athletes to understand that this isn't just about winning. So Martin was right. That's not the be-all and end-all of sport. It's about being the best you can possibly be at this sport, learning the habits of self-discipline, teamwork, and collaboration that will make for success. That's what sport should be about.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Tom Murray led the Ethical Issues Review Panel for the World Anti-Doping Agency. He's a former director of the Hastings Center and for the Center for Biomedical Ethics in the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. His new book is called Good Sport, Why Our Games Matter and How Doping Undermines Them. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Dave Potraz provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this conversation is on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for listening.